This is 4:55 on Wednesday, November 2nd.
So, just to review where we are, we are finishing the link layer today. Okay. If we don't quite finish, we'll finish it on Friday. And on Friday, we will do the exam review. I don't think we'll talk about the proxy project on Friday. We'll save that for when I get back on the 14th. So, exam review on Friday, exam on Monday, no class on Wednesday. It says TBD, but no class on Wednesday. I won't be here. And Friday is a holiday, so you have lots of time to work on your project. Or something.
So that mean we should start then?
Well, yeah, because it is due at the end of next week. So, be a good idea. So I will be gone Monday and Wednesday. I will be back Thursday. If you need to talk to me, let me know. By email, we'll get an appointment set to talk on Thursday next week. Or you could get ahead of the game and start on this week, and we could talk today or Friday. All right. Questions? So the exam rules will be like last time, which was, what, a sheet of notes?
Calculator, but we won't need it.
Well, probably, yeah. Have a calculator. Definitely you can have a calculator. I'll decide in a little while whether you whether you need it or not. Well, and you can decide whether you need it or not. All right. Questions about any of this? Yeah.
Real quick question. The thing that you're trying to do, the project, is kind of run multiple console windows. What was that program called?
It's called BYOBU. BYOBU.
Okay.
You can also do it with a simpler thing called Screen.
Yeah, but I was looking at that. But
Screen isn't quite as cool because it doesn't let you do the two-dimensional splitting of the screen, which is helpful if you need a lot of windows. Did we learn anything about the mysterious arcs? No. Anybody say, oh, that's weird? Or
They weren't sure.
Okay.
So they were going to work on something else. We're going to see if they can find out.
Okay. All right. It's not definitely not a high priority thing to look at, but I'm sure we have other things to do, but it's weird. Okay, that's that. So today we're going to talk about Ethernet and some of the ways that it has been implemented and what it shows up as in Wireshop, hopefully. All right. So remember that a IP or UDP, a TCP or UDP segment gets packaged into a datagram at the network layer, which then gets packaged into a frame at the link layer. And so let's talk about the Ethernet frame structure. The frame for Ethernet contains a destination address and a source address, an indicator of what kind of thing it contains, and then the data, which will be the packet from, or the datagram from the network layer, and then a CRC check, which you can't see. At least I can barely see it there, so I doubt if you can see that it says CRC. So we stick a bunch of stuff in the front, we stick a little bit of stuff at the end, and then we put the data from the upper layer. The preamble is kind of a physical layer confession, which won't necessarily exist in all implementations of the Ethernet, But definitely the destination address and source address are going to be visible. We'll look in a bit at what this looks like with Wireshark, just so you see it. Any questions about that? Yeah, as it says, the preamble is used to sort of, at the physical layer, synchronize the clocks of the sender and the receiver. The addresses are the MAC addresses that we talked about last time. And the way it works is that the interface hardware looks at all the traffic going by on the wires that it's attached to, and if it ever sees one that has a destination address that matches its own destination address, then it delivers it into the operating system where it then does the rest of the protocol stack. This is a bit of a lie. There are also, in addition to its own address and the broadcast address, there are also some multicast MAC addresses that will be matched optionally, depending on how the operating system has configured the interface. The type indicates the higher level protocol, which often is IP, and as we say, the CRC. This is an example of a network. The Ethernet is an example of a network that does not try to do any kind of reliability at the link layer. It send the packet, it gets damaged, you throw it away, because it's easy to fix that at the higher level. Ethernet is completely connectionless, as you might have gathered from the discussion last time. The reliability is achieved at the higher level. What else do I want to say here? No AX or NAX. Oh, and the unreliability here is actually real, right? Because of the collisions, it can happen that something gets that potentially something gets sent by the sender, and you know it's supposed to see a collision happen. The design is such that it's supposed to see a collision happen, but it rarely will happen that an Ethernet packet is in fact received damaged by the receiver and thrown away. So that's something that it's important to have that as part of the design of these things. You can't just assume it's going to work perfectly. You have to design some specific responses to these kinds of failures that occur. Okay. And so the MAC protocol is carrier sense, multiple access with collision detection. That's the
decoding of those letters.
Right. So how does it work? Nick, the network interface card, if you will. It's the adapter that hooks the computer to the network. So it gets a datagram for the upper layer. Like Aloha, it senses whether the... Well, no, Aloha doesn't. It like a CSMA algorithm, it senses whether the channel is idle, and if not, it immediately starts transmission. So it listens briefly and then starts. If it is busy, it waits for the channel to go idle for a certain small amount of time, and then it transmits. Once you start, you start transmitting the entire frame, and if you get through that process without detecting a collision, then you're done, and the Ethernet part of the process is over with. There's no memory of what you just did in this card, right? Because it's not, it doesn't have to be, it doesn't try to be reliable. If you want reliability, something at the upper, in the upper layer has to remember the packet that needs to be sent over again. Right.
So if it detects another transmission, it stops sending and sends what's called a jam signal. And the jam signal is just something that ensures that anybody on the network will have seen the collision. Right? Now it seems a little weird to say that everybody has to see the collision, but everybody has to agree that a collision occurred, and the way you do that is by sort of being insistent about sending something that says a collision occurred. And finally, after a collision, now everybody's, remember, a collision means that at least two senders tried to send at the same time, right? That's what a collision is, which means that two senders now have something they want to do, and our task is to efficiently allow them both to send what they want to send. And they can't send at the same time. So here's where the contribution of Ethernet comes into the CSMA/CD thing. It says, all right, how do we back off from trying to send? How long should we wait before trying again? We don't want to have a deterministic algorithm, because if everybody used the same deterministic algorithm, what would happen? We'd all wait the same amount of time, then we'd all both go again, and then we'd have another collision, and that would not be progress. So rather, we do a random back off that grows the amount of time that you wait grows exponentially as you suffer repeated collisions on the same packet. So suppose that we've had one collision, right? Then the NIC will make a random choice in the range 0 to 2 to the 1 minus 1 is 1. So we'll either choose to wait 0 let's call them slots for lack of a better word. Either wait 0 time slots or 1 time slot. Okay? And so, again, if we have two people trying to send at the same time, this is what we want to do, right? We want one of them on average to go immediately, and we want one of them on average to wait a bit. So you wait, you pick a K, and then you wait K times 512 bit times, which I call the slot, and go back to step two, where if you chose 0, then you immediately send the channel and start to send again. So that's the backoff scheme. And notice that what's happening here is that if you suffer a collision again, right? So suppose you suffer a collision again with this packet, that means that there's somebody else probably who's trying to send, and we're not sharing appropriately, right? If we only have two people, then we should alternate, but if we have four people, we should wait longer. And that's what this choice is trying to achieve here.
So the more collisions there are, the longer we wait between attempts to send. I think I said all that.
And if you get to 10 collisions, then it just gives up and tells the upper layer that it didn't succeed, and the upper layer can retry again or not,
as it chooses.
How efficient is it? Well, that's pretty much a lie. because T prop doesn't go to zero and T trans doesn't go to infinity, it doesn't actually go to efficiency 1. It's more like, I think, 70% efficient in real cases. Where by efficient, we mean how efficient is it when we have a lot of senders that are all trying to send at once. Clearly, if only one sender is trying to send, it will be essentially 100% efficient, minus the extra overhead for the framing. There are lots of ways to cheat, right? We can measure efficiency in terms of the network layer data, or we can measure efficiency in terms of the Ethernet layer data, which is overhead as far as the network layer is concerned.
I'm just curious, why do you think they do things like this? Because it seems like, at least fairly often, you're just like, well, this isn't entirely true or something.
Why do they do things like this?
Yeah,
to show the kinds of calculations that need to be made. Right? To show that you can... I wish they just were a little more careful, but you can sort of mathematically analyze the behavior of these systems. It isn't that you sort of set out and just design the system and say, okay, that's what it is. Right? But rather that you are able to think through and do analysis before building the system to say how efficient should be. So this is strange because this is not the actual behavior that you see in a real Ethernet, because the propagation time is not zero and the transmission time is not infinity. Okay. Well, so we talked about the original Ethernet, the thick coax, and then the thin coax, and which was thick coax was and thin were both 10 megabits per second. And then these brilliant people said, "Oh, you know what? It would be so much cooler if we could run this computer networking stuff over wires that were already in buildings, instead of having to build." To pull coax through the walls of office buildings, right? What sort of wiring was already in buildings? Telephone wiring. And how did it work? It went from the offices to what are called wiring closets, right? So from each office you had usually a bunch of telephone wires, because people thought you were going to have more than one telephone or more than one telephone line. So there was telephone wires going to these wiring closets, and people said, can we use that wiring to run computer networking? And that was a sort of physical layer design question, and some fairly brilliant people figured that out and said, yes, you could. Twister pair. Twisted pair. So that kind of wiring is called twisted pair wiring, because you take two wires and you twist them around and around each other. And the amazing thing is, electrically and signals-wise, that if you twist two wires around each other, they don't radiate into space, which means that they don't interfere with each other if you have a bunch of them all close together, and which means that you don't get a lot of loss of signal, right? If you're not radiating the signal into space, the only loss that you're incurring is the resistance of the wire, and that's not so bad over sort of office-like distances. All right, it works for telephones, right? So it's not a lot of resistance. So all of that happened, and out of that we got the so-called 10 base T networking, which was 10 megabit Ethernet over twisted pair wiring. The other thing that came along with the twisted pairs wiring was that because the wires were all going back to the same place, that was when we started getting the hubs, right? So you could plug in a whole bunch of different offices to a hub and have them all be on the network. They weren't all sort of strung out along a single wire, but rather in this star topology. I think we have a picture of that. So you have that. Then people said, well, 10 megabits isn't fast enough. I'd like to go 100 megabits. Typical office telephone wiring was not good enough for that. So that really did require upgrading the wiring. But it still used twisted pair. And the powers that be at WSU, when they built the EME building, thought it was too expensive to put in the good wiring. So although everybody was building buildings with good wiring in 1988 or whenever that building was built, the state of Washington did not pay for it. And so now, 25 years later, we have a relatively new building that still can't really do 100 megabit Ethernet except by sort of overclocking the wiring that's there and suffering problems. So anyway, that's interesting. And okay, so then after that, people said, well, 100 megabits is not fast enough. Can we go a gigabit? Well, yes, we can, again, by improving the technology of the wiring. I think it's primarily the amount of twisting and the thickness of the insulation are the electrical properties that affect how fast you can go over this wiring, and also the distances. I'm not going to talk about Manchester encoding. That's just, if you want to know about it, you can look in the book. It's the electrical level signaling for the broadcast version of Ethernet. As a software person, it never enters the picture. Okay. Never enters the picture. If you're a computer engineer, it might enter the picture, except that there are so much better encoding schemes available now that you probably won't ever encounter. I don't. What do you think, Brooke? Have you encountered Manchester encoding for anything?
No.
Right. There's just much better ways of encoding electrically. Right. So in the signals and systems classes in EE, they teach about this stuff. But it absolutely never shows up in the layers above the wires. Really. Okay. Well, so the next thing that happened, so I mentioned we got to this twisted pair wiring, and that led to the idea of hubs that you plug those into, and really the hub is just a way of creating a bus out of all this twisted pair wiring. Right? Everybody sees all the electrical signals. Everybody can collide. The hub is really a stupid device. I mean, it's just a way of connecting all those wires together. It has some electronics to make the signaling levels work out better and so forth, but it's a pretty stupid device.
and all the work continues to be done at Linux. Which means that, if you think about it, with a hub-based Ethernet, the kind of data rates that you get are 10 megabits across, shared amongst all the hosts that are attached to it. That's just like it would be with the coax. So then people said, well, gee, now all this wire is coming to the same place. Could I put some smarts in that place to make this work better? And that's how the switches came about. It works at the link layer. It acts a little bit like a router, but not very much. It actually ensures that when one network host is sending to another one, the traffic only goes across the wires that are attached to those two hosts. That's the idea of the switch. So it has to look at the MAC address, the destination MAC address, and forward the frame to the outgoing links where that frame is supposed to go. Okay. It uses So you can actually put multiple devices. Let's see if I have a picture. So here's the switch. The thing is, you don't just have to have one computer plugged into a switch. You can have multiple computers plugged into a port on a switch by using what? Another switch or a hub out here attached to a single port on the switch. So with that in mind, you look at the frame's destination MAC address. Let's put that in. And forward it to the outgoing links where that destination might be. The hosts are completely unaware of this. This was part of the beauty of how this got deployed. It's another interesting story about this networking stuff is that, of course, now we have absolutely billions of devices that all talk Ethernet. How do you upgrade the technology? Well, you have to design a path that works with the old stuff as well as the new stuff. And so that turned out to be an easy thing to do with Ethernet. And again, that's why Ethernet, another reason why Ethernet succeeded where token rings and the like didn't. So the hosts don't have to be aware of the switches at all. And the switches actually don't even have to be configured. They figure out what's going on all on their own. So let's look at how that works. I talked about sending. Right. With a switch like this, we could have three conversations all going on at 100 megabits at the same time. So the more important question is, how does the switch know where a particular MAC address is, which port it lives on? And the answer is that it learns that as the hosts come up and attach to it. So you have a table in the switch that says, for this destination, send it on this port, of course. And how does that table get created? Well, that's where this learning comes into play. When you send an Ethernet packet, remember, it contains both the source address and the destination address. So when this switch port sees a packet coming from A, it knows, oh, A is on that port. So the come from information is there, and it can add it to its switching table whenever it sees a packet from host A. And it, in order to keep this sort of viable as things change,
The switch typically doesn't remember those things for very long. 20 seconds, 30 seconds, a minute. It sort of doesn't matter too much. What happens if somebody comes and sends to a destination that the switch doesn't have in its table? In that case, you have to send it on all the outgoing links. You don't know where it is. So it's a little bit inefficient in that case. It acts more like a hub in that case because it goes to all the destinations. But as long as people remain somewhat active, it doesn't have to worry about that. The other thing is that, of course, remember that you can have multiple hosts on the same link as far as the switch is concerned. And in that case, that's acting like an Ethernet. You don't send to the same segment on which you heard the packet. Yeah?
From the sounds of it, it sounds like it only floods when there isn't a whole lot of utilization. So
yeah.
It's like it's inefficient when there's no utilization.
When you don't care. Exactly. Right. It floods if a host is sort of not saying anything, right? So you could have high utilization and some particular host is not being conversant, and that would affect everybody who was trying to be. But you know, normally most protocols have some sort of reply from a host at some level. If it's TCP, of course, there are ACK packets that go back, and that sort of insists that there be traffic in both directions. If it's UDP traffic, it's usual at the application layer that you don't just suck in packets, but rather, if you receive a packet, then at least sometimes you have something to say to somebody about what you heard. It generally works well. Selective send, we did that. What if you have more than one switch? Well, let's assume that there are no cycles for a moment. If there are no cycles in the switches, amongst the switches, and notice there aren't here, this is all arranged like a tree, then everything just works according to what I just said, right? The switches, switch 4 here will gradually learn which hosts are attached to switch 1. Doesn't need to know anything about switch 1 itself. Needs to know what hosts are attached to switch 1. It gradually learns that as these hosts send things that need to go other places. And it just works. Nothing more to say about that. Let us say one thing here, however. Suppose C wants to send to F. What will happen? And the switches know nothing about F yet. What will happen? So C sends to S1. S1 says, I don't know F, I'll flood that. So it sends it out all its links, including the one that goes to S4. S4 says, I don't know about F, I'll send it out all my links except the one I got it on. So it sends it here and here. S2 says, I don't know about F, I'll send it on all these links. F got it. S3 says the same thing and sends it to GH and I. They all ignore it. The MAC address does not match. I just did that for a different example. So what do? You typically attach
things that are important closer to the edge of the network, the router, but you can build a hierarchy to a considerable extent.
I want to get to the... Yeah. They don't talk about it. What happened to that slide? Well, okay. We do need to talk about one thing. What if I do that? In what context? In the context of a situation where we're going to do flooding. So the router, say the router is trying to send to this guy, but I'm trying to send this guy, but nobody knows anything. So what happens? I'll make it red. Router sends there. Nobody knows anything. It goes there, 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 and there. Right? And then it trickles down the wires and gets to these guys. It's there. And it goes there, 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 there. There. There and there. And then one of these gets there first, right? So I'm going to make that one be green. That one gets there first. So what happens to that? It goes out there. And then what happens? Well, it arrives there. Green is a terrible color. Let's try a dark green. That better? Yes. So now green arrives there. Well, that's a separate, as far as the switch is concerned, that's a separate thing from the one that arrived previously. So it now goes there, there, and there, and there, and arrives there, and it goes there. Uh-oh. Who's there? Two Ethernet cables into the same...
Oh, I'm sorry, the same Ethernet cable.
Into the router in two different...
In two different ports. Well, except the router typically gets configured as to its ports. And the switches don't.
Because I know that, like, in middle school, somebody did that.
Right. Well, oh yeah, there are not so much the router. It's things that create these cycles in the switches.
It slows down. It just bogs down.
Oh, it just completely. I mean, this thing is gonna start doing all kinds of things because they notice that it's worse than it seems because there's another set of packets that are going the opposite direction. Right? There's the purple ones that are going in this direction, going everywhere, and they will just, they'll multiply. You get an exponential growth and the whole thing locks up and it's very unpleasant. So, to overcome that, there are things called spanning tree protocols that we talked about a little bit in the context of broadcast, but they're also used in these switching networks to say that to help the switches figure out that, you know, it's really not a good idea to use this link. It shouldn't, it may be there physically, but let's not use it in normal operation. And then we occasionally run the spanning tree protocol to figure out which links are working and which aren't, and always operate the packet forwarding in a tree context instead of an arbitrary graph.
Okay, so that's, I wanted to be sure to mention that. Yeah.
How often does that run?
What? The spanning tree protocol? I don't know, 30 seconds or a minute or something. Do you know? I don't remember. It's just a quick calculation. And in the spanning tree protocol, what happens is essentially you do this flooding, but you keep much better track of the packets. You don't forget them immediately when what?
When
they've been forwarded, right? You remember them and say, oh, that one came around. I better not forward that one again. Oh, right. Okay, so here's the thing that people did. Here's the thing that I had people do at Park that sort of messed things up. Hooking a hub between two legs of a switch would be a bad thing. Right? Somebody walk into a conference room and say, we need to get lots of computers hooked up in this conference room. So install a hub, but rather than just hooking it to one port of the switch, they'd hook it to two ports. Well, same thing. Yeah.
On that note, are you going to talk about like the differences in the uplink port?
The differences in the uplink port. Like what?
Well, I mean, I know you can do things like load balancing, multiple wires, doing the exact same thing you're talking about, but
with intention and
but
design,
with intention, yeah.
Right? And support from the hardware. So yes. So some switches allow you to do this, and will then do essentially bandwidth sharing between those two links. They have to know that's what's going on, right? They know that both of them go to the same place, and they should only send a packet on one.
Did both of them need to know that, or just one of them?
Good question. Let's see if we can figure it out. Both of them need to know that. Because otherwise, you'll be sending double traffic to this guy. I suppose he could ignore half of it. Better if he doesn't.
And the other question I would have is, I know that specifically older, maybe it was just hubs, or maybe it was switches, or maybe it was both, they had a separate port that's
called
uplink.
Right. And so typically there were the ones that I saw had two characteristics of the uplink port. Sometimes the uplink port would be a different medium. So this was with hubs in particular. The uplink port would be a thin coax port, and then you'd have the twisted pair ports for the local machines. So that's one thing. The other thing that uplink port sometimes had was a switch on it to say, remember, well, we haven't talked about it, but if you have two devices, would help if I did it right. No, that's right. It's this one that's wrong. The old devices had distinct transmit and receive pins on the devices. And so if you were hooking to a computer, the way that it was done was different from the way you were hooking to another hub or switch. And so what the effect of the switch was to decide whether whether that crossover happened or not, depending on the position of the switch, depending on the kind of thing you were plugged into. So these days, you know, and a little bit of circuitry smarts is much cheaper to implement. It probably takes a few hundred transistors to decide which of those cases you're in and automatically do it. And that's much cheaper than having a mechanical switch.
And they do that on every port now,
right? Pretty much every port. You still run across laptops, some laptops that don't automatically do that. So if you hook just an Ethernet cable between two laptops, it may or may not work, depending on the smarts that the NIC has about figuring out what configuration of this. But also, notice that there's more to it than that. That smarts also is figuring out whether the device is running at 10 megabits or 100 megabits or a gigabit. You have to agree on that. And in modern devices, in fact, it isn't just a single wire here, it's a pair of wires, so you can actually be sending and receiving at the same time. It can be full duplex with these modern devices. So, but that's another thing that has to be negotiated between the two ends. And so the standards have developed to say what the rules are for these negotiations about who's using which wires for transmitting and receiving, what rate we're going at, and whether we're going full duplex or not. So it got a lot more complicated than that simple thing that Bob Metcalf designed on a napkin 35 years ago or so. But it has been very, very successful. Just quickly, a couple minutes. What's the difference between a switch and a router? A switch works at layer 2. A bridge is just a two-port switch. The bridges and switches work at the link layer, right? The only thing they look at is the framing information, the MAC addresses. The routers look at the IP addresses. So, for example, with the switches and the bridges, you can do what's called cut-through switching, which says I only delay the packet by long enough to look at the header and find out what the destination address is, and then immediately start sending it if that's possible given the usage of the outgoing link. Routers can't really do that. They have to get the whole packet. They have to mangle the header, look up the address, reframe, and all that stuff. I'm not going to talk about PPP. PPP is a way of doing... it's a different link layer that operates over essentially serial communication lines, like modems. Not much of that going on anymore, although it is used in DSL modem sometimes as one of the protocols there, and it's also used for tunneling and link virtualization, which I guess we will talk about next time. And we'll talk about link virtualization, and we will take a look with Wireshark at some of this traffic, and then we'll talk about the exam next time. Okay? So have a good Wednesday and Thursday, and I'll see you Friday morning.